Committee on Business Transportation and Workforce Development for Thursday. Colleagues, we only have a couple of days left and lots of bills, so bills that get talked too long will not pass. Those that we want, and people will not talk a lot. We're going to trust a lot of the stuff that our House members did, and so let's keep that in mind, because it's going to get really long here in the next couple of days. I want to open up a work session on House Bill 2538. Janet?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2538, it was the continuing education bill for the landscape contractors. You had a hearing on May 14th. This is the work session, and what you have at your place is just a conflict amendment. If House Bill 2117, which is the one that changed the name of landscape contractors, if that passes.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Montes Anderson.
I move the dash ones to House Bill 2538.
Okay. Senator Montes Anderson has moved the dash one amendment to House Bill 2538. Any comments on the amendment? Not so ordered.
Senator Mr. Chair, Montes. I move House Bill 2538 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Montes Anderson has moved House Bill 2538 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator George.
I will vote yes in the committee. I'll probably vote no on the floor.
Okay. Thank you for assisting us today with our short membership. Notice the courtesy vote by Senator George. Any other objections? Not so ordered. And I will carry the bill. Okay. Open up work session. House Bill 2107. Janet.
Chair, House Bill 2107. And you have the A2 amendments. This is the bill that required construction contractors to notify the Construction Contractors Board of any unpaid judgments or arbitration awards against the contractor, with certain exceptions. The A2 amendments were worked out with the agency and Senator Starr to say that if the imposition of a disciplinary action, the board would take into consideration any current attempts or past attempts by the contractor to make payments on the judgment.
Okay. Any questions about? Let's go ahead and introduce the amendment first.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Montes.
Yeah, I move the dash A2 amendments to House Bill 2107.
Okay, Senator Montes Anderson has moved the dash A2 amendment to House Bill 2107. Discussion, if any, on the amendment. Okay. Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2107 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Montes Anderson has moved House Bill 2107 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I'll carry those as a package there. I'll be Mr. Contractor. And Starr, that's Mark Starr, and Deckard is excused. Okay, let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2390. Janet?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2390 is the customized registration plates for recipients of the Congressional Medal of Honor. This you should have the A engrossed bill. It did pass the House 57-0, and there's a minimal fiscal impact, so there's no statement. And their Representative Esquivel is here to testify.
Okay. Representative Esquivel, please come forward. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Senator. Sal Esquivel, Representative, District 6, Medford, Oregon. This, first of all, let me give you some background. There are 111 Congressional Medal of Honor winners in the whole United States. We have one in the state of Oregon. Resides in Bend. Been here for 55 years, and has been unsuccessful for 55 years to get a Congressional Medal of Honor winner license plate from the state of Oregon. In fact, this last go-around, he was inquired about it. A fellow inquired for him on his behalf. He is a very modest person, and they wanted, the DMV wanted him to pay $18,000 and agree to purchase 500 sets of plates a year to continue on. Well, that isn't feasible, but through some work with Speaker Merkley, the governor's office, and cooperation with the DMV, we found a way in order to succeed in this acquiring of this license plate. First of all, I'd like to tell you a little bit about Bob himself. He's a Bob Maxwell. He resides in Bend. Bob first saw combat in Sicily, followed by the invasion of Anzio. He was injured during that Anzio landing and was treated in the Army Field Hospital. For his valor, he was awarded a Silver Star and a Purple Heart. He left and joined the 7th Army with the invasion of southern France. During that time, Bob, during a cold and dark night, in fact, on September 7, 1944, about 2 a.m. in the morning, the Germans started an all-out assault on the command post in which Bob was part of. They used heavy automatic weapons. In fact, I believe they used a 20-millimeter as well as including hand grenades, while Bob and three other defenders returned fire in the darks with only a .45 pistol. Several grenades hit the fence and bounced harmlessly outside. One grenade landed in their midst. Knowing that time was short and not being able to locate the grenade, Bob threw himself on the grenade, saved the three other people that he was with. The blast severely injured his leg, his foot, and his left temple. He was then taken to an aid station and evacuated to the United States, where he was in Denver, and that's when he learned that he was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. The citation of the Medal of Honor was signed by President Roosevelt and was actually on his desk when the president died, when he was in Warm Springs. Bob was awarded this by General Danielson, and he was awarded with the Congressional Medal of Honor winner after that time. He was also presented with a second Silver Star, the Bronze Star, a second Purple Heart, the French Croix de Grace, and 6 decades later, which is 60 years later, he was presented with the French Legion of Honor, which is equivalent of the Medal of Honor in the United States. Truly a decorated hero, and we're very blessed to have him in this state. I think the least we can do as a society and as a state is to recognize this individual, which we have found a way that economically it can be done, I believe, for the grand total of $55. So when people want to work, they can work together and they can get come to a means. This is what the plate will look like. You can see the Congressional Medal of Honor here, and this is what it will be for him. So we hopefully we can get this moving, get it out, and have a ceremony so we can give Bob Maxwell, our only Congressional Medal of Honor winner, his plates 55 years after he asked for.
Thank you, Representative Esquivel, and thank you for your leadership on this. And we're going to take about 3 minutes to do just that. So, Mr. McDonald, Mr. Paula Brown, Jack Evans, I'm going to give you each 60 seconds. Come on up. It's about time we get this done, so I'm not going to waste a lot of committee time on it. You guys have done a great job.
So Mr. Jack, Chairman, members of the committee, Jack Evans, Department of Transportation. And you saw the plate. This was the speaker's idea that we utilize the vanity plate program, which will cost nothing. We originally looked to the general fund for a an appropriation. The speaker challenged us to come up with something that was completely unique because there's one plate. We're able to do this, and it's a good solution. We're happy to be able to do it.
Thank you very much for all your help in the department's help in making this happen. Mr. McDonald.
Matt McDonald, United Veterans of Oregon. Simply, we support.
Thank you, Beck.
Chairman Esker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and it's certainly easy in 60 seconds or less to say the department supports this bill, as the department has supported other efforts to pay honors and recognition to veterans. I did offer and provide for each of the members the Oregon Medal of Honor recipient book, just for your enjoyment at some time later. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any questions or comments by the committee? Thank you all. Thank you all for your hard work. And I think it's time to give Mr. Maxwell his plate. So I'm going to close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2390.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2398 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Montes Anderson has moved House Bill 2398 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Any objection? So order. Please mark Senator Starr as excused. Let's see. Who's on this bill? A lot of people are on it. Let's see. They didn't ask any senators to be on the bill. Isn't that unfortunate? Who would like to have the honor of carrying this bill?
I'd love to.
Okay, Senator Mona Sanderson. Thank you very much for doing that. Okay, let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 3161. Janet.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3161 establishes a program to issue veterans recognition plates to veterans or veterans groups. There's a dash A4 amendment that's just got printed right before the meeting, so it replaces the A3s that we sent around this morning. Include the Gold Star Family plate as one of the veterans plates. You passed this, the Gold Star Family plate as Senate Bill 557. This is very similar to that bill, but it does specify that the surviving family members in lines 13 and 14 of the amendment are the parent, spouse, or dependent of a person killed in action during an armed conflict. So, again, that's the amendment, and the original bill is about a veterans plate program.
Okay, so I think Janet has explained that well, so we're putting this into the veteran plate. We've had that discussion earlier, so this is really good that everybody worked together. And Mr. McDonald, thank you for your help on that and the great idea, Mr. McDonald, and that has really, really helped tighten this up. That's just wonderful. Let's ask Mr. Evans from ODOT to come forward. And actually, Mr. Wells, why don't you come forward? Here? Nope. Mac, why don't you come back up then?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation. And this is actually the Veterans Affairs plate that Jim Willis and Paula Brown from Veterans Affairs worked very hard to put together. It will allow a number of existing veterans groups that have license plates, and there's about 11 of them, that are smaller groups that are unable to sell the mandatory 500 or renew 500 every year. This will combine them into a composite plate and will allow them, if they so choose, to become active again. This plate will be completely redesigned, and Veterans Affairs has put together a great design, and they're going to further refine that with the veterans groups. It will have a space on the left. It'll be a completely different background, have a space on the left that will then be able to have military insignia for the various branches of service or for the various awards, the Purple Heart, etc. So we're certainly in support of this and looking forward to putting this together. And as the chair mentioned, the Gold Star family, we're able to honor them on this plate as well. The bill has been amended to allow that to happen. So I'll answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Again, thank you for all your work on this. Mr. McDonald.
Matt McDonald, United Veterans of Oregon. On the dash amendment, on line 10, if we just take out section 4, it doesn't read correctly, I don't believe. I think it just should say plates may be issued for any motor vehicle registered under. And that means you take out under this section on line 10 and 9 and 10 on the original.
Excuse me, I don't follow you, Mr. McDonald.
Okay, if you go to line 10.
Of what?
Of 3161, page 1. You go to line 9 and 10, and it says plates may be issued under this section for any motor vehicle registered under ORS. If you just take out, they have taken out section 4. It just says plates may be issued for any motor vehicle.
Mr. Evans, I'm still not understanding what you're trying to say. And by the way, we're not going to amend it, Mr. McDonald, or there's no bill. So, but I don't understand. Mr. Evans, do you? I'm sorry, but I don't track even what you're saying.
Chair Metzger, I think Mr. McDonald has picked up maybe a grammatical error that I don't think changes the substance. I'm going to defer to Janet to take a look at this. But my initial look at this in the first few seconds we had being exposed to it is that it doesn't substantially change anything.
It's just a grammatical change, sir.
Yeah.
So I don't think anything is...
In this case, I don't think we're going to hold up a plate for it.
No.
You know, we can change grammar later. How's that?
No.
Great. Thank you very much. Terry Thorpe, Paula Brown, and Ed Wright, and then we will move this bill.
With the dash fours?
With the dash fours.
Okay.
Welcome again, everyone.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paula Brown. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'll stay in keeping with the 60 seconds or less. I have provided for you one of the brochures that shows the number of plates that existed, that currently exist, and I did bring the mock-up of what the plate would be thus far with the work that's been completed on it. And you'll see in the bill that there's some discussion or some language that relates to the decals. For example, if a veteran were in the Marine Corps and they chose the Marine Corps decal, they would simply have a space to put that in, and the decal would be available to them.
Great.
If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Great.
Thank you.
Who's next?
Ed Wright, policy advisor for Senator Morris, chair, committee. We're happy to have the Gold Star bill pulled it into this bill because it gives us a better background. Could I see the plate for a second, please?
Hold on. Okay.
This background is more suitable to the family who brought it forward, Debbie and her husband, mm-hmm. who had lost, Debbie had lost a child, a son, in the war and wishes to have this kind of plate honoring. The change will be that the Gold Star will be on this place right in here, and the word veteran, which is on the flat plate, will be replaced with the Gold Star family.
Right.
So it's an excellent fit between the two. And the amendment we brought in today was to restrict it to the intent of the bill for the Gold Star family,
right,
which was killed in action.
As we passed it. Yeah, thank you. Hello. Welcome.
Chairman and Senators, thank you. My name is Terry Thorpe, and I am a Gold Star mom, and I basically, I'll keep it short. I just wanted to say that as a Gold Star family, we are very proud to be under the veterans' plates, and just due to the fact that we're all special. And this is just a great place to be. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And I'm sad to say that I attended yet another funeral last Saturday in my district, ninth one that I've attended in my district, which is, when you think we have 30 Senate districts, it's pretty sad. And but the Gold Star moms were represented there again, and gave support to the spouse and mother, and it was just wonderful. And I think it's just really important. The collegial support that you give each other. So thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's close the public hearing, and I have a dash A4 amendment, and we'll open up a work session on 3161.
Chair, I move the dash A4 amendments to House Bill 3161.
Okay. Senator Monis Anderson has moved the dash A4 amendment to House Bill 3161. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3161 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Monis Anderson has moved House Bill 3161 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We'll ask Senator Morris to carry the bill again. Okay. Thank you all. Thank all of you for all your hard work. Okay, let's open up. Excuse me?
Yeah, okay.
Can you get an order here?
Yeah, well, Atkinson, I think that's what he's here for.
Where is he?
He's right there.
Oh, right in front of me. For 3527?
I believe so.
Okay, we're going to find out, won't we? Open up a public hearing on House Bill 3527. And Senator Atkinson? Yes. Staff is always right. This is. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jason Atkinson, State Senator, Southern Oregon. And it's true, I would have come up for another license plate bill, but I've given my oath to the department to stay away from license plates for a little while. I was just reviewing House Bill 3527 as they amended it. And I wanted to come and give my support to the bill and perhaps give you just a little bit of a background on this. I got the call. I know this company that the bill was written for. I know the product that the bill was written for. But most importantly, I got a call from my high school auto shop teacher, Mr. Titus, asking me if I could help with this bill. And so it is with that that if Mr. Titus is watching this from Ashland High School, I am here testifying on behalf of this bill. There's a company in Ashland that has the exclusive manufacturing rights of a car that's called the Ariel Atom. And the Ariel Atom was a car that was designed in Great Britain, and it's world-renowned because the technology that makes this car is so far in the future that Oregon law didn't know what to make of it. It's a car that the frame, the part that holds the motor, holds the passenger, everything, is actually on the outside, so there's no real body. It's considered an ectoskeleton. An outside skeleton holds this car. The car goes very fast. It goes from 0 to 100 and back to 0 in 10 seconds. It's remarkable. It's remarkable. And so they had come, and I see that Representative Buckley, Senator Bates, who represent Ashland, are on this law, or on this bill. But as you look in what the House did, is that the House, it looks like the compromise has been with the department, even though it's not a race car. It looks like the compromise that the House made was simply to allow the test driving, the sales, and probably just to get a track record of safety. And with that, I'll give it over to someone who probably was in the House working on the compromise, my good colleague from the South.
Representative Buckley, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley from South Jackson County. Thanks for giving time and attention to this bill today. I wasn't here to hear what Senator Atkinson might have informed you about the Brammo Motorsports Company, a phenomenal company opening up in Ashland. A remarkable gentleman who came up to Ashland to retire after making a substantial amount of money in the high-tech industry, but has been a car enthusiast all his life. And end up renting part of our Science Works Museum, like part of the garage space, to build a model of a British racing vehicle that he thoroughly loved, the Ariel Atom, and making everything by hand. And word got out about his ability to make these cars, and Jay Leno, the Tonight Show host, who is also a race car enthusiast, bought one of these vehicles from him, and the word started to spread about just what kind of vehicles they are and how remarkable they are. And this gentleman decided then to go into business. He would start his second career, and my favorite part of his story is that his mom, about 2 years into the production of the Ariel Atom for a wider market, his mom found a drawing that he did when he was 10 years old, and it was titled The Supercar. And he had actually drawn on the back school paper, this fantastic-looking vehicle, which, ironically enough, looks a little bit like the Ariel Atom. Uh-huh. And if I can just make a larger picture for what this company is trying to do with the creation of this vehicle. This is their frontline vehicle. They sell for about $85,000 to start, but then you can get it fixed up a little bit if you want, fixed up a little bit more. And they're using this to create a company in Ashland. Right now employs about 60 employees, living wage jobs, and they hand build these vehicles. They put about 1.5 per week. That's their rate. But behind this vehicle, they have a line of electric vehicles, clean energy vehicles, which have the potential of being a low-cost, four-seat, fully equipped electric car that will fit in the market, in the automobile market in America. His dream is that Southern Oregon will become the Detroit of the clean energy vehicle market. That's his long-term vision. This is one way economically that he can help fund that dream. And in and of itself, it's a fantastic product. The Department of Transportation and the Governor's Office was willing to work with us from day one to try to address the unique quality of this car. Right now in statute, if you build a car yourself, a kit car, you can make this exact same vehicle in your garage, and you could register it as a kit car, and you could drive it on the streets, just under the same conditions that we have here in terms of not going on the freeway with it, but on roads 55 miles per hour or less. You could drive a kit car, the exact same car. The difference is, with this bill, we're going to allow, hopefully, a manufacturer to produce these cars and to be allowed to drive them under very, very clear parameters. Cannot be driven on a road, on any road that has a speed limit of over 55 miles per hour. cannot be driven outside of a 90-mile radius, which was the proposed radius for people to come in who potentially might want to purchase this vehicle, take a test drive around Jackson County. There's a track in Medford. They can drive to the track under those safety conditions, try it out on the track, see what it's like, drive it back. That's sort of being able to register it in the state for use as a hobby vehicle is what this bill is all about. So I really am grateful to the department for working hand in hand with us to make sure that the description of the race and activity vehicle is very clearly defined to what this type of vehicle is, and to set up a system so that these vehicles can be registered in our state and used safely. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, let's ask Mr. Evans from MoDOT to come up here and see if he's going to splash water on this or anoint it.
Would it help if I sang some religious music for
him? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation. And we, of course, are neutral on this measure, but have worked hand-in-hand with Representative Buckley on it, and have carefully developed a definition which is needed in statute that pretty much matches what exactly this vehicle is. And we ask that these restrictions be also placed on the vehicle, making it closer to what special interest vehicles do now with parades and clubs, and then capturing the idea, the British idea of the track day concept that Bramall Motors has been interested in, where you take this car out of your house, you drive it to the track, and then open it up and then drive it back home, and hence that 90-mile radius. And then we also restricted it to highways of with no greater than 55 miles an hour. So with that, we really have no problems. We'll see what happens.
We will, won't we? What do you think?
I was just wondering if our fellow colleagues got rides in the car and why we didn't. If you did, that's it.
Yeah, the ones that are here to vote can get the ride. Thank you. Let's close the public hearing, open work session, House Bill 3527.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3527 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Modest Anderson has moved House Bill 3527 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Zoom, zoom. Any discussion? Any objections? All for the love of cars.
Bates is
Let's now. Ask, is it Bates? Is, yeah, okay. Bates. Senator Bates will be the carrier of this bill.
Show those two excused.
And, yes, show the other two members, our colleagues, as excused. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2435. Janet.
Chair, House Bill 2435 is at the request of the Auto Appraisers of Oregon, and would create a two appraiser certification system, one for a regular appraiser and one for a master appraiser, to be issued by the Department of Transportation. There is already an appraiser certification process. This would make a dual process, but also add a new violation, Section 2 of the bill, right on the front page, and you should have the A in gross bill, that a violation for appraising a vehicle or representing that you're an appraiser without having one of these two certifications. And that would be a Class A violation, which is a serious, that's the top of the violations. Thank you.
Let's ask Monty King to come forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Monty King. I'm Executive Director of Auto Appraisers of Oregon. We worked hard on this bill for about 4 years, basically. Tried to include everybody in the process. We tried to meet every objection. I've got written testimony. I'm not going to go through it in the interest of saving times. I want to make sure you know that this does not create a barrier coming into this industry. Anybody who has the experience can get their license, no education, no nothing. It does create a system where they could get some education and get their license, too. We have not increased the price of a license, of a regular appraiser license. We did make it into a three-year license instead of a two-year license, but still $25 a year. We're going to write some rules over the next few months, if this passes, to make and include everybody in that process. Want to make sure that it's understood that just because you help your friend value a vehicle, you're not appraising. We're talking about people who do appraising for compensation. Somebody who is in the business of doing that. Creates the master appraiser level. A little bit higher fee, but that's what the appraisers at the meeting wanted. They want a little bit higher fee. We're talking $50 a year. We are talking about in the rules process of having some education for the master appraisers. We're talking about minimal. We're not talking expensive. Most education around the industry now is about $15 to $20 a credit hour. That's not bad. And we expect probably there'll be two or three people who do get certified as those instructors in those programs. Training helps local governments, private companies get qualified, and licensed people to do their abandoned appraisals. And if you have any questions, I'm glad to answer that.
Well, thank you, Mr. King. Yeah, my first question is, because we're referring to a couple of sections of the Oregon Vehicle Code. So this, the vehicle appraiser and the master appraiser, does that, is that then covered for all vehicles of any type or just certain vehicles that this applies to?
We're talking vehicles. We're mainly talking about cars, trucks, collectors, whatever.
But any kind of vehicle.
Any kind of vehicles. If somebody wants to pay somebody to say, I want you to appraise my vehicle for some reason, then they should have an appraiser's license. And they'll be registered to do business in Oregon, and there'll be a list of them out there where people can pick them. There's a lot of different reasons.
And tell me the difference between a master appraiser and a standard appraiser.
The standard appraiser is somebody who has 2 years of experience or more who wants to get a dealer, an appraiser license. The master appraiser, we will put in rule what that level is. We're looking at probably somebody with 10 years of experience who has had a 3 or 4 hour class, whatever they want to do in that respect. We're probably looking at three or four hour class. So somebody who has vast experience, who has some training, who wants that certification level. Nobody would be required to have a master if they didn't want it. But it would open some doors for them of being a master.
Okay, Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that's the question. What's the market difference for a master? I mean, is our insurance companies going to only hire master appraisers versus regular appraisers? I mean, I can't quite see the need for them in the market for the two different appraisal levels. Are there certain people who want more than just a traditional vehicle appraiser's license?
Senator George, yes, there are people who do want to be recognized for their vast experience.
But I mean, is there a market difference? Sorry, Mr. Chair. Would that create a market advantage in that certain companies, like insurance companies, will only hire master appraisers? Or will the courts only accept the testimony of a master appraiser? Do you see what I'm saying?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I don't know what they would do. Certainly there is a need for a master appraiser when there is a difference of opinion between appraisers. I think that's generally when you'll see the master level come into effect. I'm sure there's some market difference between a master appraiser. He's probably going to be charging more than a regular appraiser. If he charges more, then he's going to cut his business down. But when there is a, like in a wrecked car, and one person says, well, it's worth this much, and one person says, no, it's worth a lot less, then they can each get their own appraiser. And if those appraisers agree on a price, then that's what they're going to get. If they can't agree, then that's the appropriate time for a master appraiser maybe to be involved. It doesn't, nowhere does it require a master appraiser at that level, but at least there would be a list out there of master appraisers that those people who want that resolution could go for.
I guess that my only follow-up, there is no effort then to try to put in statute that the master appraiser would have abilities with the courts or with somebody else with an advantage over a traditional, somebody who has a standard appraiser's license. There's no efforts to try to give market advantage to these master appraisers other than what the free market may allow.
Chairman, Senator George, that is correct. There's no effort here or in rural or anything to try and give that kind of an advantage to one part or the other.
Okay.
No.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. Okay. I have one person signed up in opposition, and somebody who didn't sign up, who signed up and didn't tell me what he wanted, but they have the same last name.
No, I signed up.
Oh, okay. Mr. Vandermeer? She signed you up, actually, twice. That's why you are on here twice.
Does that mean I get twice as much?
No. But I'm sure you'll make your point very succinctly.
I hope to. Senators, thank you very much. I've got some material here I'd like to present to you.
Identify yourself for the record.
I'm Gary Vandermeer with Vandercraft Resources. I'm an independent auto appraiser in Lane County, and I work with the Oregon Independent Auto Appraisers Group down in Lane County.
Okay.
Should I provide this material
yes.
to you?
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, first of all, let me thank you for your time today. I appreciate the opportunity to present testimony in this area. I'm speaking in opposition to it, and if I could briefly outline my reasons for this. Each piece of legislation as it moves forward is theoretically to offer some improvement in the lives of Oregonians. This bill has two objectives as defined in its summary. One is to create two types of auto appraisers. The other is to bring every appraiser in the state under the regulation of the Department of Transportation. The summary begs the question, what will this bill do to improve the lives of Oregonians? Where are the dead bodies in the street because the state lacks a two-tier auto appraiser system? Where are the busloads of aggrieved Oregonians here to testify how they were bilked out of their life savings as a result of out-of-control auto appraisers? I don't think they've showed up yet. The answer, of course, to these questions is that there is no blood in the streets and there is no pent-up demand for the state regulation of auto appraisers. No one who testifies here today will be able to offer any concrete economic data verifying any harm that will come to the people of this state if this legislation does not move forward. Who is going to benefit from this legislation? Let's utilize that old Watergate axiom of follow the money. There's a very limited cadre who, because they will become more exclusive and becoming an auto appraiser will become more difficult, they will gain an economic advantage. It will reduce the number of people who will serve this position to help people out. I am primarily a consumer advocate in what I do. The more expensive it is for me and for others to go through the process to get approvals, the more expensive it's going to be for our clients, the harder it's going to be for the average person to be able to access our services to help them out. The losers in this are obviously the consumers in the state of Oregon, and we have to look at the cost to the Department of Motor Vehicles in order to create this program. There has been no financial impact statement that's been submitted on this that I've seen. In talking with a number of people at meetings where this bill was being hashed out, the question arose, what would the cost to the state be in order to implement this program? Knowledgeable people referenced as high as possibly $18 million. By the time you get through writing the software, installing it, creating the program, certificates, there's a lot of expense involved with this. And to what advantage to the citizens of the state of Oregon? Quite frankly, I can see none. Senator George has had an excellent question regarding any benefit in the master certificate program. There is no demonstrated need for a two-tier system. There is no advantage that's being offered to create this. It creates an additional level of work that has to be done by the DMV. I would encourage you to drop the two-tier system if the appraisal process is to go forward and reduce it to a single appraisal certificate at this point. Should the need be demonstrated in the future, we can always add a second level. But at this point,
there is no advantage to either consumer, the state, or the court to have this two-step, two-tier certification process. I want to thank you very much for the time you've given me. The two things I would ask you to consider if this legislation were to move forward would be to, one, under Section 2, where it states appraises a vehicle, there's really a lack of definition here as to what exactly that is. There have been some assurances that if somebody's next-door neighbor wants to help them out and offer assistance in doing a vehicle evaluation, that they won't be clipped for being an unlicensed appraiser. But there's nothing in writing that codifies that. This would add definition to who exactly an appraiser is and what an appraisal is, and I would encourage you to consider adding that definition to reduce the possibility of legal squabbles in the future. The other thing would be to add a section that would act as a grandfather clause to protect those people who are currently offering services as appraisers, and there's a variety of different people. Attorneys that work in divorce cases, in estate settlements, people who are doing valuations as part of car clubs for members for insurance purposes. These folks will all need to be brought up to speed on what is happening, and if they so choose, if certification is required, that they can apply for it without fear of coming in and facing a $720 penalty. I hope that information is helpful for you and provides some additional insight and another perspective on this proposed legislation, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Vandermeer. So you have you're a currently certified appraiser?
No.
You're not?
State doesn't require it. However, I've applied because I see some handwriting on the wall.
I'm just looking at the existing language. We do have certificates now of some kind according to existing language. So in other words, you don't have to have a certificate to appraise currently. Is that
you do okay? Not. However, the state does offer a appraiser certificate. Uh-huh. And so if the state chose to have a certification program, there's already an existing program. Nothing would be required to be created new.
Mm-hmm.
We could merely use the same current standards and apply those for the proposed appraisal certification.
Okay, thank you. Questions from Mr. Vandermeer? Senator Montanaro.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there other states that have a master appraiser system?
There are a variety of different programs. Every state seems to have its own bent. Most states that I'm familiar with who do have a program that is strictly for a single-tier appraiser. People who wish to offer testimony in court, who provide expert testimony in rare exotic vehicles. Normally there are other things on their resume which will empower them to be able to provide that information, either experience as, say, a judge at a Concours d'Elegance, perhaps some extensive training, perhaps experience on the club level and intimate knowledge of a vehicle. But normally it's just a single-tier appraisal authorization or certificate in most of the states that I'm familiar with.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Vandermeer.
Senator, thank you very much. I appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you. Let's ask Daryl, Norm, and Paul, who are coming in support of the bill, to come forward. Careful.
Senator Metzger, I'm Paul Gustafson. This is Norman Barron, Daryl Ford. I'm president of the Oregon Consumer League. I also make my living as an appraiser. I do hold the certification license that DMV now has. As of 4 months ago, all that certification was, it said, abandon appraisers, motor vehicle appraisers license. Through my position on as a committee member and consumer advocate for ODAC, Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee, I presented the problem to them and asked if we could get a certificate and remove the word abandoned from it so that there could be a certification program for appraisers. reason for that is, from a consumer standpoint, person charges, from an appraisal standpoint, we're charging anywhere from $125 to $350, depending on the appraisal situation, whether it's a total loss or just a valuation for an insurance company. Consumers need some protection in knowing that that appraisal has some worth and some value behind it. And for years as an appraiser, before certification happened, when I did an appraisal for an insurance company or for a consumer who had a question over total loss or is fighting an insurance company over total loss, once they turn that appraisal into the insurance adjuster, the adjuster will come back and say, well, is there a certified appraisal? Well, there was no certification program, so the consumer would have to say no. So this is something the insurance company has been asking for years. And that's one reason to put some meat behind the appraisal once it's turned in. It also saves costs not only in the court system. In other words, in everybody's insurance policy, if you have comp and collision on your cars, there is an arbitration clause, and it calls for a competent and disinterested auto appraiser to represent the consumer and one for the insurance company. The two appraisers can agree, as Monty King said, on value once they've looked at the car, then that's what the consumer gets. If they can't agree, then the policy arbitration wording calls for a third appraiser to act as an umpire or a tiebreaker. That is where the upper tier or the master could be very useful. And the reason why is, for years I've been fighting this, what makes people think that if the first two appraisers can't agree on value, what makes them think that they can agree on who the third's going to be? It's the same thing two attorneys face when they're in an arbitration. They have the presiding judge of the court pick who that third is going to be. In this situation, the only presiding judge in Oregon in the past 5 years, and he's now deceased, now he's Judge Launder, he was the only presiding judge that understood the process, that he had the power to select who the third would be, but he had no list of who would be competent for that. The master appraiser's list would help the judges and the presiding judges in doing that.
Okay. Thank you. Next comment?
I'm Norm Barron. I have my own appraisal company, All Appraisal Company. I've run into the same thing Paul spoke about many times, where I have a client relate to me that his insurance agent required him to get an appraisal from a licensed, certified appraiser. Over the years, I had to tell these people that no such thing is really exists or is available, yet repeatedly the insurance industry has asked both claimants and insureds to secure the services of a licensed certified appraiser. So we're really just filling a niche that everybody thought was there all along. As regards resolution of claims disputes, simply being an appraiser and knowing what a car value is doesn't mean you'll give good representation to the consumer when it gets to the little more legal landscape involved in an arbitration. There are so many facets to that alone. As Paul said, one of them is, if you can't agree on an umpire, you know, how do you proceed? Well, most appraisers don't know that, you know, what even the policy language is, much less that it needs to be an appraiser and that you can petition the court to have an umpire selected, which I've done many times in California, Oregon, and Washington, where I'm certified by the courts as an expert on vehicle values and diminished value. I act as umpire very often between other appraisers, and I think it would be extremely beneficial to be able to say certified master appraiser and have that nomenclature. It also lets the consumer know right away that they have somebody they have recourse with if their case doesn't go very well. If it's Johnny's friend next door who's representing him as an appraiser and he doesn't pay anything for the appraisal, when the appraisal goes wrong, you know, he has no real recourse. He hasn't paid anything. Where are his damages? And it's unfortunate because, you know, a vehicle is the second biggest purchase that most consumers make in their entire life. You know, you can buy a car on a 10-year program now. You're talking about a vast difference of opinion and value between one side and the other. You need somebody who's disinterested and who has that background to make that decision fairly for the consumer.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Kaur.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a real quick question?
Yeah.
In your testimony, you just said that there is no such appraiser license currently out there. But this is current law. It says there is an appraiser certificate. So I didn't quite understand your
appraisal certificate is fairly recent. Prior to the changing of the terminology, it said abandoned appraiser.
Oh, okay.
Under current law today, there is an appraiser's license available, and I have one.
I just didn't understand what you'd said based on that. Okay. So the current law is that there is an appraiser's license right now.
Yeah. And is there training required for that?
Not right now.
Fee?
Well, there's qualifications that DMV has for it.
Uh-huh.
An insurance background as an adjuster or in the automotive industry as...
Two years of prior experience.
I see. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. Before I begin my remarks, to Senator George's question, the law has always said that there's a vehicle appraiser certificate, but when the rules were adopted at DMV, for whatever reason, they adopted rules that talked about an abandoned vehicle certificate. So all of the licenses, cards that went out always said abandoned vehicle appraiser certificate, even though the statute didn't narrow it to that. So people that had a certification as an appraiser, when they'd show that to somebody, it indicated that it was only for abandoned vehicles. And when it was pointed out that the rules didn't match the statute, DMV backed off of the abandoned part of that, and so we were left with a vehicle appraiser certificate in statute. What brought us to the table is that it's the only place in law that I can think of where the state of Oregon issues a license but says you don't have to have the license to do the business. Imagine the state of Oregon saying, we're going to issue driver's licenses, but you don't have to have one to drive. And we're going to issue a license to do whatever it is, whatever professional license or whatever certification we have, but in order to be a professional in that industry, you're not required to have the certification. In our opinion, you either get rid of the certificate because it's not required, or if you're going to issue a certificate and say this is what certifies you to be a part of this business, then everybody ought to have it. It just makes sense. You shouldn't be able to buy and sell cars for a living without a dealer's license. Otherwise, what's the purpose of having a dealer's license? Right now, you have to have 2 years of experience in an auto-related industry in order to get the certification. So if I worked at a car wash for 2 years, I'm qualified to be a licensed appraiser in the state of Oregon. What we're doing in this bill here is allowing a task force to be put together to adopt rules that says what should it really take to be a vehicle appraiser. What are the educational requirements? If you have no experience at all but want to be an appraiser, is there an education process you can go through to be certified? Or if you have demonstrated experience in an auto-related industry that would allow you to be certified without education, what is that experience? What is good enough to qualify you to get that certification? And if you have a lot of experience in the industry and you want to be a master certified appraiser, that is somebody that has a demonstrated background and has achieved perhaps a second level of experience that would designate them as a master appraiser. And so we think this is a good bill and look forward to working with all interested parties, including those that are opposed to the bill, in drafting the administrative rules.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I don't know if you were using hyperbole or not. The agency hasn't adopted rules that explain what an automotive-related industry is, because that kind of seems crazy that you could be, I don't know if the agency could be there, but that you could be in the car wash and consider that. I mean, I find it really hard to reach. I don't know if you're maybe using hyperbole or... There has to be some kind of
Mr. Chair, Senator George, the rules say you have to have 2 years of auto-related experience. Nobody's ever asked, and my understanding, and I don't represent DMV, but my understanding is there aren't any rules that go beyond that, so it would be up to DMV to decide whether your 2 years of experience qualify or not. It's a bit of hyperbole to say, hey, if I wash cars for 2 years, it's an auto-related business, don't I qualify? Would DMV possibly turn that down? It's possible, but there's not sufficient specificity in either the statute or the rules to make having the certification of significant value, and you don't have to have the certification in order to do the job, which again begs the question, why even have a certification if you're not going to make it worthwhile?
It's just we didn't change that in the law, and I'm thinking, well, if that's a problem, then we had to change that in the law. So
we certainly wouldn't the rules.
Here's just a couple of questions on this, or thoughts about it. Number one is, I don't see anything as I read the language that would qualify anybody, any of you folks who have an appraisal now, to still have one. In other words, there's no grandfathering of you in here that everybody would have to apply under the new rules to be certified. So you're not going to be able, you know, you will lose your certification as soon as this passes. You're going to have to meet the same standards.
That's correct.
That was intended. There's no grandfather clause.
Chair Metzger, the part of the law that doesn't change is that there is a certification process.
Right.
Okay, so those people that are currently certified that have a two-year license, they would have to renew their license under whatever the new rules
right.
are, but it wouldn't void their existing license.
Right, but until their license is up, they would have to qualify. And the second thing is, and I think Mr. Vandermeer, point is very important on line 11, where you know because you're making a Class A violation for someone who praises a vehicle, I think it would be a significant a point that should apply to someone who actually is acting as a business, in other words, appraising a vehicle for compensation as a professional rather than just appraise a vehicle, because. I could see Uncle Joe, you know, saying here, I think this is worth so-and-so, take your 37 Ford down to the Peterson auction, but wasn't getting paid, wasn't representing themselves. I think that would be an important one. What I'd like to do is, we have a little constitutional issue on the bill at the moment because of those issues, so I threw them out to you. So I'm going to close the public hearing, and I think it would be valuable to talk to Mr. Vandermeer about a couple of those issues, and maybe Mr. Evans with ODOT. I'd only have one more time to bring it back, but I think the committee is a little uncomfortable about a couple of those issues on that, and see if those might be able to be solved. Okay? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2435, and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2704. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2704 would allow the Department of Transportation to include one of its questions on the driving driver license written exam, a question about fuel-efficient driving techniques. Thank you. I haven't found the bill yet.
Thank you. We have Representative Ken for the first time before our committee, and he's going to tell us what kind of automobile he drives and how many miles a gallon he gets.
Very good, Mr. Chair. For your record, Ben Cannon, State Representative, District 46, I am driving a friend's car that I'm borrowing, so I can't tell you much about it except that it's a blue Toyota pickup truck that seems to get about 30 miles a gallon, which I was really impressed by. My Saturn, my regular car that my wife is using full-time right now, gets sort of 34 or so. Anyway, great to be here. I'm going to be very brief. I know you have a very busy schedule. I handed you written testimony. I'm not going to read it. I am simply going to encourage you to move 2704 to the Senate floor. This is a permissive bill that allows the Department of Transportation through DMV to include test questions related to fuel-efficient driving techniques on its test for driver's licenses. I've listed some of the advantages of following fuel-efficient driving techniques. They're probably familiar to you, although I admit that I'm not always considerate of all of them. They can optimally help improve your fuel efficiency by as much as 50%. And so we have a real opportunity to use education through the manual that is provided in conjunction with the test and the test to help encourage Oregonians to save gas, reduce our state and our country's dependence on foreign oil, do well for the environment, and save themselves money. So with that, I encourage you to pass this bill on. It is unopposed, I believe, by DMV. We worked with them to get it to a point where they were comfortable with it. It did pass the House floor with, I believe, 39 aye votes, and I encourage your support.
Thank you, Representative. Question, Senator George.
Representative, I guess the only concern I had about this, and it's because it's a great goal, and so I don't object to that, but if, in theory, a person could actually fail their driver's test if they miss these questions. So you could have somebody who's actually completely competent to drive on the road but misses a fuel efficiency question and ends up not getting their driver's license, and that kind of concerns me a little bit. I wouldn't mind having it included in the manual, but the actual part of the test then, it really doesn't matter. I mean, I wish everybody would drive fuel efficiently, but it doesn't necessarily govern whether they can drive or not.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator George, I could have the department perhaps to say how they intend to use this. My understanding from conversations with them is that this would allow them to put perhaps a question out of the 30-question test related to fuel efficiency. Now, if the standard for passing the test is 20 and they missed 9 other questions plus this one, you could argue that it was this one that resulted in their loss. But I don't expect that what we would see if this bill passes is a whole bunch of questions on fuel efficiency that the driver, if they failed, would then fail the test. If they missed, would then fail the test. So, yes, under certain circumstances, you can imagine how missing that this one question would result in that. But I think that'd be very, very unlikely.
Mr. Cameron, do you want to come forward?
Mr. Chair, while he's coming forward, I think it's a really good idea when we're talking about environmental impacts and especially since we're driving more, and even though the cost of gas is going up more, we're still driving more, and so fuel efficient, no matter how small, is important.
Thank you. Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation. And as Representative Cannon points out, yes, this is what we would do would be add this material to the drive manual, and we open that up every year and revise it. So in January, approximately, new material will be added to the drive manual that everyone would study for the exams. There is a pool of about 200 to 250 questions from which an examination of 35 questions is sampled every time that somebody comes up to take an exam. There are some domains, however, that are chosen and that have a higher probability of getting a question, and those include the rules of the road, traffic signs, there's safe operation around pedestrians and bicyclists and some of these things. We would put this question a couple of questions, in a domain that would cause it to be probably sampled on every other test. So I don't know that it would be the cause of somebody flunking their drive test, but it would show up, a question would show up probably on 50% of the examinations. And we're in agreement. We think it's a good idea for folks to study this stuff and be aware of it.
Okay. More questions? Well, the question I would suggest would be most fuel-efficient way to drive your car would be live as close to where you work as possible and not jam up the freeway so I can drive around. I think that would be my question. Senator George.
I don't mean to get high-sided because I'm not going to oppose the bill if we want to move it out today. So, but I guess the flip side of that is that if on 50% of the questions, there is one question that is removed that has to do with the rules of the road, so we can put a fuel efficiency question there, then that person has fewer questions that have to do with whether or not they actually have driving skills. And those two things really make me concerned about this. And so, I mean, I love the idea of having this in the manual because this information needs to be known. It's just that once it goes into the test should be about whether or not they can drive, not whether or not they know how to save fuel, because it's a driving test, not an environmentally conscious test. And that's my concern about this bill, is that I love the idea of it being in the manual, and I think we ought to keep bringing this up as an educational effort. But once it goes into the test, you change the meaning of that test, and then at what point do we put other socially conscious decisions in a driving test that have nothing to do with whether or not the person has the skill set to drive? So there's my concern, because you got it both ways. One is you could fail the test because you put that in there, and the other one is we're not quite testing people completely on their driving skills if they have one of those questions in there. So I didn't know if that was...
So my response to that would be, Senator George, Chair Metzger, simply that it is a policy choice for the legislature. Do we want to head this direction with the driving test? I think that 29 out of, I think it's a 30-question test. 34 out of 35 questions related to driver safety, the rights of pedestrians, cyclists, following traffic signs, et cetera, is sufficient to ensure that folks are going to know the rules of the road. At the same time, they have the added benefit of learning a bit about fuel-efficient driving.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I actually think that actually taking the driver's test, they still do that, don't they, where they have to get in the car and prove that they can skill. That's still extremely important part of the test, too.
You know, I remember when I took my driver's test that, you know, the thing I always had to practice the most was with the cones, you know, so that I could parallel park. But now, you know, they've got cars that park the parallel park themselves. So, I mean, it's just getting easier all the time. We'll close the public hearing, open a work session, and Representative Cannon, you'll take a note how efficient we are in the Senate and that we are very helpful to our members, even if they might have a concern about the bill.
Chair, I move House Bill 2704 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Montes Anderson has moved House Bill 2704 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Okay. Any objection? Thank you very much for allowing this to move forward, Representative Cannon. Thank you very much. Let's see, do you have any co-sponsors on this bill? Nope, they're all House members, and we don't allow them to speak on the Senate floor. So, I'm going to ask Senator Deckert to carry the bill because he's not here. So, you know, if you might, you give your talking points to Senator Deckert. Yes, I'm sure both our colleagues is excused. We'll put up public hearing on House Bill 2936, Janet.
Mr. Chair, this is the Transportation Christmas Tree Bill.
Well, the weather outside.
There are two unrelated provisions in the A engrossed bill that came from the House, and then a third unrelated provision in the dash A4 amendments. The first provision, and that is in, you don't see it until you get to page 5 of the bill, but it's all one section. It reduces the registration fee for motorhomes from $126 to $54 and lengthens the number of feet. That's all it does. And then the second provision, sorry, is you see on page 7 of the bill, which increases the penalty from a Class D to a Class A traffic violation for truck drivers who violate certain size and weight limits. And then the dash A4 amendments create a Class C traffic violation for failure to remove a vehicle from a highway after an accident. And that should look familiar to you because you passed a similar, very similar amendment to Senate Bill 566, which is in the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's ask Bob Russell and John Phillips, who have both signed up in support of the bill, to come forward.
And Mr. Chair, at your place, excuse me, there's also a fiscal and a revenue impact statement related to the Parks Department. There is a loss of revenue from the decrease in the registration fees for uniforms.
Thank you very much. Mr. Russell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell, president of the Oregon Trucking Associations, and Ms. Atkins, instead of a Christmas tree bill, I think this is truly a buddy bill. I'm going to speak to the provision that I have in the bill, which is the last part in the existing language. You may recall a few weeks ago you had House Bill 2902 that was dealing with size and weight penalties for truck drivers, and in that particular bill we were reducing the penalties because in some instances folks were getting tickets in excess of $6,000, and we reduced it to a Class A traffic infraction when they did not get their size and weight permit. And at that time, I told you that our original intention was to have another provision in that bill, but because of some drafting confusion, it didn't make it there, so it is here. And what this does is it increases the fine if someone does not adhere to the provisions in their size and weight permit. Typically, and where this came up and what brought it to our attention, is that right now there are manufactured homes that are coming from the factories up Highway 22. They go on Marion County roads because the overpasses are too low on Highway 22. And in a number of instances, the waymaster from Marion County had noticed these wide mobile homes on a very narrow two-lane county road that didn't have the required pilot cars to warn motorists that the wide load was approaching. And the comment was made that it was cheaper to get the ticket than to hire the pilot cars. And we said, whoa, this doesn't work for safety. So we said we would come here and we would ask to increase the fine so it's more than the cost of hiring the pilot cars. Now, it's not just people that are transporting
mobile homes that are guilty of this infraction. Certainly there are others, but that's the purpose of this, is to make sure that the penalty is high enough that the folks actually go out and hire the pilot cars and make sure that our highways are safe. So that's my piece of the buddy bill.
Okay, let's go, Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips. I'm here representing myself. I'm not representing my employer, so I'm on official leave right now. Just want to make that for the record. And the bill on page 5, in lines 21 and 22, are a deal with my portion of the bill. It represented Clem brought for me on my behalf, and that bill was gutted and stuffed with another issue. But he fortunately, we found this bill. And 4 points I just wanted to make in the handout, I won't belabor, but the similarity between the 6 vehicles in the bill are that the one vehicle is taxed at almost 3 times as much as the other in terms of the registration fee. I did not mistakenly say tax, because I think even though the registration fee is a fee for use of the highways, in this case, for motorhomes, the fee is actually sent to the Parks Department. And you don't necessarily even have to use a park in Oregon to pay this fee. So it's really kind of unrelated to the fee itself and the use for which it's levied. The label is a bit inaccurate, because these vehicles are vans just like the other vans in the picture. One, the numbers, the middle two, for example, are exactly the same size, shape, weight, height, width. One registered as a passenger vehicle, the other is registered as a motorhome. Most of the vehicles I've seen out there are registered as passenger vehicles, even though they are motorhomes technically under the law. That might be because they're not familiar with the law for whatever reason, but it seems like the law is complied with by exception rather than the rule. So anyway, there's some confusion about that. People probably wonder why driving around a van to Home Depot or going to a soccer game or to the store to get groceries in a van like that, you would be paying 3 times the vehicle registration fee. So our thought was is that if a vehicle is the same size and shape as a normal everyday passenger vehicle, and 14 feet seemed to be the breaking point, that the fee should be the same. And that is testimony I'd like to share with you today.
Mr. Phillips, are any of these vehicles yours?
Yes, the caramel colored one in the middle right.
Oh, I had a funny feeling. Senator George.
Mr. Russell, this only applies to people, the increase in the fee only applies to people who went out and got a variance permit, so they know what the parameters of their permit is, and then they violate those parameters. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, that is correct. That okay. It's in the permit that has the provisions.
So they're fully informed on what.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer from the City of Portland is going to talk about the Dash 4 amendments.
Not for long.
But I wanted to let you know that we support the Dash 4s as we did when you put it in Senate Bill 566.
Okay, thank you. Hold on. Yeah, staff has a question. You're in trouble now when Janet has a question.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just thought of this. Bob, is it going to be cheaper to not get the permit at all than under the first bill than to get the permit and be violating it?
Mr. Chairman, Janet, the fine that we set for not getting the permit was also $495. The permit cost $8. I think that we have the incentive there to obtain the permit.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Evans, Mr. Landauer. Tell me, Mr. Evans, if you have any issues with the bill, and we'll discuss those.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jack Evans, the Department of Transportation. No, we have no issues with the bill. We're fine with those amendments, and have had discussions with Parks about the revenue loss, which we had to modify a little bit of the bill because it was going to be higher. But with those changes, we're all just fine with it.
Okay. Thank you. So Mr. Landauer, we've had this issue before, and maybe you could that we've already passed, but of course a bill went into 566, which currently is in Ways and Means, and you have absolutely no confidence in the chair of this committee that that bill is going to come out of Ways and Means. So would you please explain why, and then why we should continue to pass it again?
Insurance, Mr. Chairman, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland. Thank you very much. We saw that this was another opportunity to attach what we believe is a very important measure to reduce congestion in not only the City of Portland, but also across other areas of the state. It's an important safety matter for us, and we want to keep traffic moving, reduce congestion, and keep our economy going. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Landauer. Any questions? People get real nervous when bills are in Ways and Means right now. Close public hearing, open a work session. We have an A4 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the A4 amendments to House Bill 2936.
Senator Monis Anderson has moved the A4 amendment to House Bill 2936. Discussion? Senator George.
I just wanted to say that I'm really disappointed. I've got to do something nice for the city of Portland. It just hurts my feelings, something terrible.
Disappointment will be so noted for the record. Any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Chair, I move House Bill 2936 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Monis Anderson has moved House Bill 2936 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We will mark Senator Starr as excused. We have no Senate member on this bill. I think what I'll do is I think I'll give it to Senator Starr because he's our trucker. Okay. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2537.
Jen. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2537, and you have the A engrossed version of the bill, prohibits employees of mass transit districts, transportation districts, and any municipal bus systems from striking or recognizing a picket line while performing official duties, and there is an emergency clause and no fiscal or revenue impact.
Okay, Mr. Marquis, Mr. Martin. The M&M boys here. Mr. Marquis is a proponent, so we'll ask him to begin.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis on behalf of Amalgamated Transit Union. I have... Our president, John Hunt, was unable to be here today, and so I have some written testimony that he delivered in the House.
Okay.
This bill comes to you from the Amalgamated Transit Union. It is very simple and straightforward. It would prohibit employees of mass transit district, transportation districts, from striking. They would then use arbitration to resolve their labor disputes. The Amalgamated Transit Union has a long history of doing so, both in this state and in many other states. Our local represents people in the state of Washington. The state of Washington adopted similar legislation to this many years ago, and that system has worked very well up there. The bill came out of the House Business and Labor Committee unanimously, passed the floor of the House with 54 votes. TriMet has taken a neutral position on this bill. That is the largest transit employer in this state. Salem Chariots has not opposed the bill, continues to not oppose the bill, nor does Lane County Transit. I'm not sure if that equates to neutral, but they are certainly not opposed, and have not their boards have not taken a position to oppose the bill. Other states that have similar legislation, Louisiana, Illinois, Maryland, Minnesota, Wisconsin, the process works well there. Our union believes that arbitration is a much better system to resolve these kinds of labor disputes in transit districts, particularly in larger metropolitan areas. I think we could all understand that there might be some public safety concerns and many other concerns if TriMet were shut down for a week or 2 weeks. The federal government used to require that transit districts submit to binding arbitration at the request of the union. They do no longer require that, but our international union does require our members to request arbitration prior to ever striking, and we've always done so and followed that procedure. We just believe it's a better system. It's not about giving anybody an advantage in the system. It is about a more orderly management of these districts and labor disputes. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Well, we'll go to Mr. Martin and have him tell us why he wants him to strike.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Roger Martin. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Transit Association. We oppose the bill, and that's by a vote of the board of directors of the Oregon Transit Association. I'd like to give you some background. Public transit started in my era around this building. 40-some years ago. In 1964, anticipating that the then-existing private bus systems in Oregon were eventually going to go broke, Mel Schopert, who was both the president of the Amalgamated Transit Union and the only lobbyist for more than 10 years here, came to the legislature and got an initiative to allow the transfer, this is history now, allow the transfer of the private pension plans over to the public sector. It took a constitutional amendment. He anticipated this was coming. We passed legislation in 1969 and 71. I was the chair of the committee to set up transit systems. We have two kinds. We have transit districts, which are the three that were just mentioned by the proponent, and we have transportation districts. Most of these are unionized. Mel Schopert was asked when the union labor negotiations were set up, what form of final decision would you like for a contract? And he chose the right to strike. This is a choice by the union, not by us. That's worked well for the last 40 years. There's been one strike. It was a messy one down in Eugene. You might be interested that the general manager is no longer there that was the general manager during that, directly because of the way the labor negotiations were handled. Any person who does these for a living is going to tell you that binding arbitration will raise the cost of labor. The Oregon Transit Association came to this legislature and said, we have real serious financial problems, and so far this is the only bill that's passing, and this is just going to raise our cost of doing business. They don't have any help to help solve it. You're talking about a union that is one of the top industrial unions in the state for salary, for retirement benefits, for health benefits. It's not like they're desperate. The teachers' union should do as well as the Amalgamated Transit Union does. And I have talked at length to the attorney in Portland that does most of these labor negotiations for management, and he is furious. He says just inevitably it's going to raise the cost of all the business across the line. And he says, and I will ask all of you when you vote for this bill, come back in 2 years and count the number of binding arbitrations versus the one strike in the last 40 years, you're going to be amazed how many went straight to arbitration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Okay, let's you're taking the argument about the cost that you brought up. Certainly a legitimate argument. How do we juxtapose that to the public health and safety is to ensure transportation? You know, we've seen, you know, different situations across the country, New York City and others. We could see in Portland or Eugene, where the mass transit is a critical part of the economy and the safety and health of individuals. So how do we weigh what you talk about as a potential cost because of this methodology versus the strike possibility and its impact on the public in terms of the public policy discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I would only argue that the past history of the 40 years, there has never been a strike in the Tri-Met area, nor in Salem. The one strike was in Eugene, and both parties understand that a transit strike is a very nasty thing. If nothing else, it inconveniences the public. In Paris, for instance, where the unions there regularly, they have an interesting way of negotiating, they strike certain lines. When the French Open is on, the underground line that serves whatever the, I can't pronounce the name.
Roland Garros,
surprisingly has half the service. They're on half strike. It's a labor tool. It's happened, but I don't think there's any history in Oregon to show that we are endangering the public, because both sides understand they need to negotiate at the table and come to a conclusion. This, in my mind, and in the mind of the attorney that does most of this, is going to simply say they're going to go to arbitration every time. What do they have to lose?
Thank you. Mr. Markey, do you have any just comments at all?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just believe that this is a better way to resolve strikes, and perhaps it wasn't 40 years ago. I can't tell you what was in Mel Schopert's mind 40 years ago. I did know him. I respected him. But things change, and we believe that this is the best way to resolve these disputes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Markey. Okay, members, we have no one else signed up to testify on this bill. This is really, the bill is really your decision. I would entertain discussion by the committee because we're down the home stretch. So it is your decision. Any thoughts you have on it? Any thoughts you want to share with me? Or do you just want to vote and find out then?
Mr. Chair, I guess the thing that I'd want to learn more about is binding arbitration. Not being having a great deal of experience in labor negotiations, what is it about that binding arbitration that would raise the cost? And so I think that would be the item that I feel like I would want to learn more about when I listen to the testimony. That's kind of where I stuck.
Well, you guys might want to come back up. All right, so we have a question. Before we have you respond to that, Mr. Martin or Mr. Markey, colleagues, any other thoughts or concerns or issues or, you know, your temperature, and we'll try to see where we are.
It just appears to me that if we've only had one strike, is there a problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moss Anderson, first of all, not to correct my old friend Roger here, but we did have a strike in Salem last year. We had a strike in Lane County the year before. We didn't have strikes for many, many years because in my testimony I said the federal government required districts to submit to arbitration if the union requested to do so. But all of that is past history, and under the old arbitration rules in Oregon, the arbitrator came in and both sides made their case, and then the arbitrator made a decision, and oftentimes the people complained about the arbitrators splitting the baby, if you will. But, and that's why in Oregon we went to a system of binding arbitration called last best offer, and most of you probably have heard of that, and that's how firefighters and other public safety employees resolve their labor disputes. And in the end, if the dispute can't be resolved, each side has to submit their last best offer, and the arbitrator has to choose between the two, and it forces people to the middle, and it forces people to get real, because if your last best offer is way out there, it's simply not going to get accepted. And so it's worked very well. It works very well in Washington, and we believe that from the particularly the public safety issue, that this is the way that these disputes need to be resolved.
Okay. Other thoughts? Senator George, what's your thinking on this?
Well, binding arbitration is one of those things where it's tough because the arbitrator's in the awkward position of being needing to be at least picking with the union sometimes and with management sometimes. And so what you end up getting is that you end up getting the sort of, they're always picking from one or the other, and you can have wage inflation that way. I guess my view on this is sort of a mixed bag for both parties. And I suppose if you really need to move the bill, I'd be willing to vote for it, in as much as I don't see TriMet and these guys really, although I appreciate Mr. Martin's view, I don't see that some of the agencies aren't in here saying this is a really bad idea. At the same time, I really think at some point in the future we're going to have a discussion about binding arbitration and the process that does, because I don't think for a lot of our – what it does is it creates wage inflation. Everybody just needs to recognize that. But at the same time, there is a downside risk to the unions also going this route. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, you bring up a very good point, Senator George. I'd like to ask Mr. Martin that. Mr. Markey represented that TriMet was neutral. I believe Chariot Salem was neutral, and Lane County Transit.
Correct that. Olivia Clark and I have spoken about this, yes, and she authorized me on occasion to tell people that TriMet is neutral on this bill. We even talked with them. They had original concerns that our employees might come under the benefits of that would accrue under Senate Bill 400. You're all familiar with that, I'm sure. We amended the bill in the House to provide that our employees would not have those benefits of Senate Bill 400 accrue to them, so we wouldn't have the right to safety issues and staffing levels. TriMet is absolutely neutral on this bill. Now, I talked with a board member from Salem, and there was discussion about opposing the bill or supporting, and they have, as far as I know, taken no position on this bill.
And
Lane County Transit testified in the House that they had no position on the bill. Now, somebody asked them if that was neutral, and they said, we have no position. Okay. So I don't know if no position is different than neutral.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. I guess I'm just, because you represent the those. You told me that you told the committee that your group has come out in opposition to the bill. We got three major ones that are playing like Brer Rabbit here and just kind of hiding and not saying anything.
Mr. Chairman,
so I'm trying to get you know,
these people have upcoming labor negotiations and they're fearful. This is a tough union. You all need to realize the ATU is damn tough. General manager at Lane Transit went toe-to-toe with the Amalgamated Transit Union, and they sponsored a local initiative to cut her salary in half, and it passed. So these folks don't want to get in a fight with the ATU. I don't have to directly. I get along with Jim very well, and we work together on a lot of things. But let's face it, this is a tough union, and they've done very, very well. You're just giving them one more tool to do even better. And if you're going to do that, at least somewhere along the line, the transit systems need some money to go with it. Now, if you want to know details of how binding arbitration works, I'd be happy to bring Aiken Blitz down here, who's the leading attorney in the state that negotiates these things. You probably don't have the time to do that.
Okay. You know, I tell you what, this is what I'm going to do with my colleagues. I know we only have a day left, but I can sense there's a lot of angst on the committee, as I have, in terms of some of these questions. I definitely don't want to have a bill going out to the floor that I don't know I have votes for. I'm not saying there isn't, but I think there's a question there. I am concerned that I don't have I'm concerned of why, you know, I mean, I understand your explanation, Mr. Martin, but if something as big as this, to not have those people in the room, I don't want them in my offices or my colleagues' offices saying to them what they wouldn't say in front of this committee. So I will bring the bill. I'm going to bring this bill back on Wednesday. I want to have our caucus. We'll discuss that. Senator Georgiou probably will. Give Mr. Marquis, Mr. Martin time to talk to make sure that the direction we go is that people have their questions answered. I think that would be best rather than perhaps sending a bill to the floor and then having it roll over day after day. I don't think anybody would want that. So let's close public hearing, House Bill 2537. We're going to get those people out of the weeds and find out what they really think. Before we conclude, I'm going to ask for an informational briefing real briefly. Ask Mr. Evans to come forward. Earlier this afternoon, colleagues, we had a discussion about vehicle appraisers. I just asked, I want Mr. Evans to come forward. We had a number of discussions before the committee about the grandfather clause issue, compensation, you know, defining appraisers as those who actually do something for competition, what the definition of an appraiser was. The chair was handed a note suggesting that some of those things could be handled in the rule process. So I want to know, Mr. Evans, from you, whether that is accurate or whether the legislation, if this were to even go forward, would have to contain those types of definitions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jack Evans with the Department of Transportation. You're correct. Those are items that we plan to address in rulemaking. This is new territory for DMV to establish educational requirements and deal with a master appraiser certificate. And we intend to fully involve the industry in this rulemaking. And we will be addressing the issues of grandfathering. We can address, I had not heard that definitional problem with appraiser, and we'll certainly be able to address that. The issue of not sanctioning someone for appraising a vehicle, not for compensation, your Uncle Joe not having a certificate and appraising a vehicle, that's certainly not the intent that there would be sanctions for that type of an individual, and that we intend to, and we do intend to address in the rulemaking process. So the rulemaking process is going to be wide open and involve as many people and from various parts of the industry as possible. There were some misconceptions voiced that I can perhaps clear up that I heard. One was A multi-million dollar fiscal was mentioned at some part in the testimony, and we're more in the $40,000 range to have the staff implement this and do the rulemaking, have the AG involved, and a little bit of programming. So that's going to be the cost.
Okay. So before, Mr. Senator, if you'd be kind enough to stay, before I decide whether to reopen the work session, we had those issues. Mr. Evans believes that they will be addressed. How does the committee feel? Is this something you would like to reopen the work session or not for?
Mr. Chair, the only problem I have with the bill is to start in with appraiser and a master appraiser. At this point in time, I'm more comfortable with just having the appraiser. But again, this is the industry wish, or at least some proponents. Some are not shaking their heads, others are nodding. And so,
okay, thank you, Senator George.
I'll vote for the bill. I'd prefer it the way the Senator most anxious said, which is I'd prefer to have the master appraiser taken out. I don't even see the purpose of it, and there doesn't seem to be a market. And what I'm worried about is at some point in the future, the only people that can do certain jobs in the appraisal business is these master appraisers, which is a market barrier. So I'll vote for the bill if the committee wants to go with it and if that's what we'll do, but I would prefer that we take the master appraiser.
Okay. I don't think it would be wise to open up the work session again. So that's fine. We are going to be meeting again on Wednesday. We will not obviously have a meeting on Monday because it's Memorial Day. We have two meetings left. Janet, would you give us an idea of what the amount of work that we have scheduled for our Wednesday meeting? And we have an evening meeting that day, too.
Carry this one over then.
Mr. Chair, and members, the Wednesday meeting is, we have 15 bills on the agenda. About four or five of them are work sessions, so they shouldn't take very long. But we meet from 1 to 3, recess at 3, come back at 5 in hearing room 50 in the basement, and go until you, I don't know if you have set a time limit for ending, but...
No.
The more we talk, the longer it goes.
Well, we'll try to keep it as succinct as possible, and I know, because you all have your committees, and this will be the last time for people to have their bills. We've kind of kept Thursday, the final day, open without scheduled bills, so that problems that do arise, that people will have 24 hours to try and fix them, but then we're going to be done, and we do want to give everybody an opportunity for their bill if they can convince the committee of it, so I would appreciate... everybody being on time on Wednesday and then the evening session to get this stuff wrapped up. Thank you very much for everybody's help, and we are adjourned.